And I will trust in you alone, and I will trust in you alone. Did you hear that really quotable quote, that great text from the reading from Jeremiah? Cursed, a bit strong word, I don't like it very much, but cursed, it says, is the one who trusts in man, but blessed is the one who trusts in God. Both our readings today were about where you should put your trust and where you shouldn't put your trust. I mentioned that this coming Wednesday is the 16th anniversary of when my mum died. Most of my memories of my mum involve my dad as well, partly because if dad and I went off and did something together, mum would stay at home, but mum and I probably didn't spend much time, just the two of us, after about sort of preschool really. And mum died many years before dad did, so there are memories of mum, but they tend to have dad in them. I was an only child, so we were the kind of, you know, three musketeers who did everything together. Even at teenage, when other kids might be going out with their mates, we lived in a very rural area, and, you know, all my school friends came by bus from far and far away, different directions. So even then, as a teenager, mum, dad and I would do stuff together. We'd drive down to the Sandbanks ferry and sit watching the ferry go to and fro in the car and listen to the band on the light programme and eating fish and chips out of newspaper. You know, good quality time, just the three of us together. One particular memory comes to me as I hear today's Old Testament lesson, and it's from a day in 1963. I was very young then, of course. But I walked into the living room, and there's mum and dad sitting there, and there's this air of gloom and despondency that was tangible. And I had to ask, what on earth has happened? What's caused this? And it turned out some bloke called JF Kennedy had died. And when I sort of inquired about it, well, he was someone they'd never even met, and he was president of a country they'd never been to, and as it turned out, never would go to. Why was it such a big deal? Over the ensuing weeks, I discovered that the whole world seemed to be in mourning because of the assassination of this John F. Kennedy. And of course, in America itself, they went into overdrive with their mourning and their grief. In no time, they were naming things after him: roads, bridges, universities, libraries, sports stadia, islands. There was an airport named after him. There was even, inappropriately as it turned out, an aircraft carrier named after him. I say inappropriate because the things he was known for, first of all, his politics seemed to appeal to people across the spectrum because he seemed to have found a way of raising up the poor without punishing the rich. Also, his character was loved because whereas most politicians can be rather serious characters, he had a true sense of fun. But mainly, he was a peacemaker. And so recent were the memories of World War II that what the world really wanted was someone who would build peace. He founded something he called the Peace Corps. You know, at an age when young people might do national service, which in most countries means learning how to kill people, he established this Peace Corps, which meant going to what in those days we would have called third world countries, developing countries in other words, and running agricultural and technological and educational projects to benefit the local people. That was what he thought was worthwhile. And of course, when he was assassinated, the real problem was that all those things he might have gone on to do now wouldn't be done. You'll know this from the people you've lost, the people you've spoken about who you've lost. You know, this morning, it's not just that you feel sad looking at the past. It's not just that you feel empty looking at the present. It's that there are things you assumed you would do with them in the future, places you thought you'd go to them, stories you were going to tell them and hadn't got round to it. There was a book my mum had asked to borrow from me. I was about to loan it to her. I never could. You know, it's the future that's changed most when someone dies. And how much more is that true of public figures, from John F. Kennedy to Martin Luther King Jr., to Princess Diana, and all those actors and singers you can think of where they died young and people said, what might they have gone on to do if only they'd lived? So if you've felt that and you understand where I'm coming from, you now know exactly the context of that reading from Jeremiah 17, when a popular king called Josiah had just died. Here's the background. The small country called Judah included just two of the 12 tribes of Israel and was the area basically around Jerusalem. It had a succession of kings that are named in the Book of Kings. And the Book of Kings will say, this king did good in the sight of the Lord, this king did evil in the sight of the Lord, this one did good, this one did evil. There are no shades of grey in the Book of Kings, right? But one of the best of the lot was this guy called Josiah. He came to the throne of Judah in 640 BCE at the age of 8. Right? So obviously he ruled under some sort of custodianship for a while. But by the time he was 21, he'd really taken his task seriously and was carrying out reforms, political reforms, religious reforms that were popular right across the board with everyone. Why do I mention the age of 21? Well, because it says at the beginning of the book of Jeremiah that that's the year in which Jeremiah started prophesying, the 13th year of Josiah's reign. And the fact that the king was so popular and that people had so much hope in him may go some way to explaining why Jeremiah has that reputation as a miserable old so-and-so. Yeah, a pessimist. Because, you see, while it's the job of prophets to comfort the afflicted, for example, when the Jews were in exile in Babylon, to tell them, comfort ye, you're going to go home. Similarly, it's the job of prophets to afflict the comfortable. And everyone was just a bit too optimistic during the reign of Josiah. Everything's going to be fine forever because Josiah's going to be here and he's going to lead us forever. And Jeremiah was just trying to introduce a touch of realism and say, well, hang on, you know, Josiah may not be here forever. And then, of course, in a sense, his words came true rather dramatically. At the age of 39, Josiah was killed in battle at Megiddo. And the nation of Judah was plunged into mourning. Not just that formal, polite, respectable mourning you do because, you know, a head of state has died. But they genuinely felt that all the things they had hoped for the future of their nation, now were not going to happen. Because he was gone. And it was in that context that Jeremiah spoke those words that you heard. Cursed is the one who trusts in man. He's not talking about humankind in general. He's not, despite the unfortunate sort of translation, talking about the male of the species as opposed to the female. He's not saying, don't trust in a man like Josiah because he's sinful, though he probably is, or because he's faithless, though he possibly is, or because he breaks his promises, though he no doubt sometimes does. But don't trust in a man because he'll die. Man is mortal, but God is immortal. So he says, don't put your trust in man, but blessed is the one who trusts in the Lord. It's that contrast between something that's temporal and something that's eternal. You know the minister of my church, Reverend Sidney Samuel Lake. I know you know him because he told me he'd been here. And he wished me well for this morning's service, which was very nice of him. And last Sunday evening at a service, Sidney Samuel said, there's one thing everyone in this room has in common, we're all going to die. Well, that really cheered everybody up on a Sunday evening, you know. But to kind of lighten the moment, he then quipped, you know, I myself, Sidney Samuel, confidently expect to live another 150 years yet. Sort of comment I'd make in a sermon just to get a quick laugh, you know. But that is the point of that reading. You know, people die so you can't put your trust in people. And it's the same point in the gospel where we're told, woe to those who, woe to you who are wealthy or are laughing or are popular or are well fed. Well, what's wrong with those things? Nothing's wrong with those things, except they do not last. They're things you might expect to last, but they don't. Now, when I took early retirement, it was technically redundancy, so I was given a little pot of money to tide me over. And so I invested that somewhere. Now, in the last 3 months of 2018, the value of that pot of money went down 7%. Doesn't make any difference to me. You know, I hadn't invested it 3 months ago and I wasn't needing to take it out now. But just suppose at the end of September, I'd thought, at last, I've saved enough money for something I want to buy. I'll just put it there and I'll go and deal with buying what I've got to buy and sign the contracts and so on. And then I'll take it out 3 months later. And what would I have found? I can't afford it anymore. It's gone down 7%. So even when, you know, you're relatively, well, you're very much wealthy in world terms, in global terms, you can understand something of how wealth cannot be relied upon. Another example would be property. I've lived in my house now for 36 years. And of course, over that time, the value has gone gradually up and up and up, as it would do over the years. I haven't done anything. I've just lived there, kept it maintained, kept it painted, you know, repaired anything that breaks, and it's gone up a bit. But in the year 2017, the market value of houses like mine in my street went down 8%. And in the subsequent year, 2018, they went down a further 15%. Mathematicians among you will know straight away that you can't add those two figures together because they're percentages of different bases to start with. But over the last 24 months, the market value of my house has gone down 22%. Now, that doesn't matter to me because I didn't buy it 2 years ago and I'm not selling it now. But just suppose I had bought it 2 years ago and now my circumstances were changing. I was getting divorced. My company was moving me to a different part of the country. I was needing nursing care and I had to move out. I would be in negative equity over those 2 years. I wouldn't be able to afford to pay off the mortgage, would I? So even those of us who in global terms are relatively well off can appreciate the fact that wealth cannot be relied on. In contrast with those things that people try to rely on but shouldn't, Jesus gives a list of blesseds. Blessed are you who are poor. Well, that's a strange thing to say, especially given that the word for poor that Luke uses, the Greek word, doesn't just mean, you know, a bit hard up at the moment. It means desperately, desperately poor and at rock bottom. Then he says, blessed are you who hunger. And the word doesn't mean feeling a bit peckish. It means starving. And then he says, blessed are you who weep. And he doesn't use a word that means you're sobbing a bit. He means you're crying your eyes out. And then he says, blessed are you when people oppose you for the sake of the Son of Man. I suspect Luke has made sure those words go in there because at the time he wrote his gospel, the people he was writing it for were Christians who were being persecuted and were being opposed on all fronts. And they're being offered a blessing. And don't ever think that word blessed can be translated happy. I mean, you know, blessed are those who weep. Well, it can't be, you know, happy are those who are sad, can it? That doesn't make any sense. It's receiving God's blessings, not because God wants you in that situation, but because God does want you to rely on him. And it's only circumstances like these that make people cease to try and be self-reliant and understand their ultimate reliance upon God. And Jesus says these words because people have come to him seeking blessing in the form of healing, in the form of wholeness. They have sought blessing. He's offered them the blessings they seek, but he said, let me also tell you something about the source of true blessedness. And he's saying that to all these people who've come from far reaches, we're told, Tyre and Sidon and goodness knows where. But he's also, did you notice a very strange phrase that it said that he looked at his apostles as he said these words? So he's speaking to everyone, but he's specifically targeting in some way the apostles. Now, of course, this is because, as Enid told you, the very last thing that happened before today's reading was Jesus designated 12 of his many disciples to be the apostles. They are named in the three verses before where we picked the reading up, as you heard. So this is kind of their ordination sermon, right? He's telling them what they have just been signed up for. And it is possible, isn't it, to preach to a target group, but also for there to be something for everyone else as well. Philip Beistel came and took an all-age worship service at my church a few weeks ago, and there were two children there. They're sitting together in the middle somewhere. So for a lot of the time, he just went to the pew in front of them, and he looked down, and he preached to them, and stuck a microphone in front of them and asked them questions. But there was stuff in what he was saying that was relevant to and appropriate for all the others who were listening in. It happens at wedding services all the time. The priest will speak to the couple, but everything that she or he says will also have some relevance to other people who've been married for a long time, perhaps, or are contemplating marriage in the future. Perhaps the best example of this kind of thing is what will happen this afternoon at the service where Neil Wingrove gets accredited as an official Methodist local preacher. Claire Potter will be giving what's called the charge, in other words, preaching the sermon this afternoon, and a lot of us will go to hear her. And she will probably direct what she has to say at Neil, because it's his day when he becomes a local preacher officially. But there'll be things she says, I've no doubt, that are relevant to others of us who preach or are engaged in other forms of ministry. So that's what Jesus is doing. He's talking to everyone, but he's doing something specific for the apostles. And what he's doing for them is, he's reminding them that God cannot bless people in the ways that have been mentioned remotely. He can't say, right, that person's hungry, from a distance I'll just drop some food onto their lap. It doesn't work that way. He doesn't say, someone there is weeping, I will send a smile and put it on their face. It doesn't work like that. He has human agents who minister to those people who are at rock bottom, and that's the kind of role to which those apostles were being called, and the role to which we are all called. A retired Anglican canon told me that he visited a Christian couple in their home, an elderly couple, and they said in the course of conversation something that I'm sure many of you will think you may have said, or that you have heard other people say. They said, we've been greatly blessed in our lives. They were referring, of course, to the fact that they'd probably had a nice home and reasonably good health. They'd got a nice family around them, some gorgeous grandchildren. They said, we've been greatly blessed in our lives. And this canon said he so wanted to say to them, yes, but are you living the Beatitudes? Because our calling is to follow Jesus' example in being agents of blessing to those in our world who need it most. Amen.